History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold. As long as some of us are willing to take a little initiative and ask some questions, then to be patient enough to listen as long-buried memories start to filter back to the surface. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really do end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Earlier this week in Provo, Utah, a memorial service for a 101-year-old veteran featured his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, but also had many watching live from overseas in tribute to a man whose inspired act of kindness more than 70 years ago really did change the world. I'm talking about the Berlin Candy Bomber, Colonel Gail Halverson, who passed away last week. Our conversation with Hal, or Uncle Wiggly Wings, as he's revered in Germany, has long been one of the most listened to episodes at hometownheroesradio.com. If you pull up that web address now, you'll find a YouTube link to the entire memorial service for this humble hero of the Berlin airlift after World War II. Let's listen to a brief excerpt right now from his daughter, Denise.
We know our Heavenly Father brought him home at the time that was right. His mission on earth will continue in our hearts forever as he starts his new mission in heaven. His example is permanent. Uncle Wiggly Wings passed away peacefully and unexpectedly, surrounded by family on February 16, 2022. He taught us all the importance of attitude, gratitude, and service before self. Dad had the gift of a positive attitude, quick wit, and even more than that, a way to make every person feel special and that he knew them. He expressed gratitude for everything and taught us that through small acts of kindness, we can bring miracles into the lives of others. He is a man of action, adventure, and faith. Every night, even at 101 years old, he knelt with a struggle by his bed to pray. And one of my sweetest memories is hearing him pray so many nights. He could not sit still. He always looked for problems to solve. The bigger, the better. Hard work and perseverance win, no matter the odds. By small and simple things are great things brought to pass. We will miss him dearly. The world needs more heroes like Hal.
Indeed, it does. One way to carry on his legacy is by supporting the Gail S. Halverson Aviation Education Foundation. I have that info for you online as well. But some of you haven't heard his story before, and we want to take some time to listen to it as he told it today. We'll hear more from the memorial service later and conclude with Gail Halverson reading a poem that he wrote in the cockpit more than 75 years ago. But let's begin with where his love of aviation began. As a boy growing up on a Utah farm.
Working out in the field and throwing hay up in the hay wagon or thinning sugar beets, see an airplane come out through the blue sky and head up north to Idaho. And I'd stop and watch, and Dad said, well, you watch long enough, get back to work. And I was enthralled with airplanes from the beginning, so that was in my blood. The contrast was the farm work every day, and it was a good life, a really good life. I don't know how I could have had a better, more love and hard work and good lessons from a dad, good dad and mom. In 1941, before the war started, I competed with a bunch of guys from Salt Lake, Ogden, and Northern Utah for a flight scholarship. We had about 140 going to ground school, and they gave 10 scholarships. Well, I memorized everything being in the farm, so I got a free ride to get a private pilot license, me and 10 other guys. We didn't have any money, but we pulled up $50 a piece, and that's $500 and bought an airplane. It was a Franklin 55 horsepower engine with single ignition. That means if the ignition quits, you're a glider. So you learn to look out for emergency landing places. So I had a great time with that, and we got going, and Pearl Harbor came along, and of course we signed up and got in the Army Air Corps. But that's how I got started to fly, and I loved it. I got a lot of time didn't have any money to buy gas at that airplane. Spent my $50 on buying the airplane with other guys. So I had a really good buddy, Conrad Steffen, in Tremont, in Utah. He wanted to see what flying like was like. I said, well, I'm an expert. I got 35 hours. I'll show you how to do it. And so I gave him a ride, and he bought all the gas. So I flew a lot because he had a pretty good bank account. So we did a lot of flying together. I sure enjoyed Conrad Steffen.
Well, and you mentioned then Pearl Harbor happened, and then you ended up in the Army Air Corps after that. What do you remember about that day and how that news hit you, that all of a sudden your country has been attacked and the world has changed a little bit? Do you remember how you found out?
Yes, I was listening to car radio. I even had a radio in those days. good for radio. I love it. I love radio. But just the news broke up and the man came in. I thought they was doing one of these crazy shows, you know. I just didn't believe it. The Japanese, clear over there from Japan, would be bombing Pearl Harbor. It was beyond my belief. And then I thought, well, I'm glad I got a pilot license. I know I won't be. So I felt sorry for the guys slugging on the ground, our buddies that was part of the team. But I always wanted to fly. So I remember it. I just didn't believe it for a while. So I got a local radio broadcast that said it's true, that's underway. And so we were very much concerned then for the future. At that time, of course, the real heroes for me were the RAF pilots defending Great Britain. The guys that are flying day and night, going up at night to intercept the German bombers. I was just enthralled with those. And Chesley Peterson was a guy that lives not in Utah, not too far. He'd enlisted in the RAF quite a bit earlier. And he added another dimension, knowing the Utah guy was out there flying the RAF before Pearl Harbor. So they were my ideal. And when I signed up for aviation cadet training, and when we got to San Antonio, Texas for pre-flight, they had a notice on the board. It said, who wants to train with the RAF? And man, I ran in right quick and said, hey, I want to train with the RAF. They said, well, okay, we'll talk to you about it. And the Brits were training their pilots in the States during the bombing. Of course, they had more room in Canada and the United States. So I ended up in a flight training, RAF training in Miami, Oklahoma. That's how I got into the business and ended up with the Royal Air Force as a fighter pilot. When I got sent back to the Army Air Corps, they needed cargo guys. And that was a blow. But anyway, I really enjoyed my time flying the transport business in lots of parts of the country, and that got me into Berlin Airlift, so that's not all bad.
Was there ever a point, as you're training, and you say your heroes were the guys defending Great Britain and all those Spitfires and the mosquito bombers and everything that they were flying over there, was there ever a point as you're pursuing these aviation dreams that you thought, you know, I might be risking my life here?
Well, growing up on the farm, I used to try to ride my brother's horse. His horse was beyond my raider skill level, and when he'd take off, I'd ride his horse. So I always had a feeling of maybe pushing the envelope a little bit there. I had no real fear of flying. A few times in the air, I questioned that decision, but I just knew that I was going to fly no matter what happens. And I had confidence in the mechanics and the equipment, and if you end up being a glider, there must be a place to land it somewhere, miss the neighbor's house and land in the field. No, I didn't ever really have any apprehension about getting up in the airplane.
Well, that's the second time that's come up, that engine-powered aircraft could become an engineless aircraft and you could become a glider. And it's probably a little easier to accomplish that in that Franklin you had at first than a big cargo plane. Were there some times in your career where you had to deal with those kind of situations where you lost engine power?
Yes. Taking off out of Rio de Janeiro one day and looked out there, and all of a sudden, my right engine was engulfed in flames. I mean, it was just burning. I was in the Rio de Janeiro harbor, had hardly any altitude, and there was a big fire going on. But it went through the regular procedure, feathering the engine, stopping the engine, putting out the fire extinguisher to that engine, just pull the handle and get the fire extinguisher, and put the fire out, got the engine feathered. The problem was, I was maximum gross weight. I was headed from Rio de Janeiro to Brazil, in northern Natal, Brazil, on the north coast. And so I was maximum gross weight, but I was at sea level. So I got there, got around on one engine and put it back down again. Well, I've lost several engines, so to speak, and four-engine airplane, but that's no problem. If it doesn't burn up on you. Well, I've lost an engine on the airlift, too, several times. But four engines is pretty comfortable. It's not like losing one of two.
Well, and I think there are a lot of people out there saying easy for you to say, and maybe they wouldn't be so confident in that. And you mentioned Rio de Janeiro to Brazil. And I guess the timeline is important on that, because probably a lot of people and all the veterans we have on this show, you know, primarily they served in Europe or they served somewhere in the Pacific. Maybe early on they were in North Africa, maybe up in the Aleutians. But it's not very often that you hear about South America during the World War II era. But that's where you were during that time. Can you explain what you were doing and what the significance of it was?
That was unusual. You know, I put in for fighters and then up in transports. But when they assigned me to South Atlantic Theater, and we were flying supplies from Florida all the way down to Rio de Janeiro. But that was when we had twin-engine airplanes. Then we got the C-54 while I was in Natal, Brazil. We were stationed in Natal, Brazil. I got assigned a C-54 then. And then we started flying out of Natal east to Ascension Island in Africa. And that was a good run. And out of Natal, we would ferry airplanes. If the guys were bringing down a bomber that was going to England to replace aircraft there, they'd go the southern route in the wintertime down to Natal to Ascension Island, then on over to Africa, and then up to England. And sometimes the airplane would break down in Natal. My buddies and I would draw straws to see who got to deliver it to England while the war was going on. But did that a couple of times, and I enjoyed that. I had quite a lot of variety flying out of there, but flew missions mostly to Ascension Island and Africa and back to the States occasionally and as far south as Argentina. It was a challenging environment, nothing like being shot at. Those guys always had my admiration, and I felt kind of left out, you know, in a way, but I was doing what I was told to do, and I did the best job I could.
What about when World War II came to a close? Well, the war in Europe, VE Day. Was that a big deal to you? I mean, here you've been carrying all these supplies, flying all these flights, trying to support this overall effort. When you got that news that Germany had surrendered, did that mean something?
Yeah, I met some of my buddies who were doing the heavy work. We're going to be able to come home. And it was the end of losing some of them. I've lost several buddies that, of course, as everybody has. And I was just grateful for that. And grateful that it was over for them that were doing the heavy-duty stuff. And now they get back and reacquainted with the families and start the new life. Either some stayed in the military and a lot got out. But it was a ton of weight come off your shoulders on behalf of our people in the Army and the Navy and all those that were in harm's way in behalf of freedom. It was just a new world, a new bright world out there.
You know, and as you mentioned that you were thankful for your buddies, I'm thinking back to something you told us a few minutes ago, that when you got assigned to cargo planes, you felt a little left out. Here you had dreamt about flying the fighters and all of that. Looking back now, how do you feel all about that? And does it seem to you like fighters wasn't the plan for you? And if you had been in fighters, you might not be here?
Well, that was always a possibility. So I just don't try and dwell too much on the past and say that's been done and that's the way they want it. And so you accommodate to it. But, you know, you just take the path that you're given. And if you waste time looking in the rearview mirror too long, you miss the turn off on what you might become.
And what he became was a globally revered humanitarian hero. It's time for our first break, but when this special tribute episode of Hometown Heroes continues, we'll hear how Gail Halverson became the Berlin Candy Bomber. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a link to the entire memorial service, and we'll be right back after this.